going deep. And he's got his receiver, Adams. Slicing in for the touchdown.
Pulse of the Pack Podcast.
Play in big running room. And headed to the end zone is Aaron Jones.
Aaron Jones.
Give that man the ball.
Pulse of the Pack Podcast.
Do you want to experience the thrill of a Packers game at Lambeau Field? If so, be sure to get your game tickets from the longtime trusted source in Wisconsin, Ticket King. Visit their locations in Milwaukee and Green Bay, or just go to their website, theticketking.com. Again, that's theticketking.com.
It's my best impression of a train because the D train and the Green Bay Packers are en route to San Francisco. The Seattle Seahawks are done, gone. That demon is exercised no longer. They didn't win by two scores like I told you they would on Saturday, but they did win. And as Aaron Rodgers said in his presser and his media availability last week, the most important part that you guys are missing is the win part. And they have now won 14 times and, more importantly, one time in the playoffs. And they are going to play for the NFC Championship game. The worst 13-3, most fraudulent 13-3 team ever is four quarters away from being the most fraudulent team to play in a Super Bowl. And we're all three excited about it. That's why we have three people here tonight instead of two. I'm your host. I am Jacob Westendorf, joined as always by the great, not gray, great. That's how good of a mood I am. Great Jason Perrone. Jason, don't shake your head at me. What do you got to say today?
You're already starting off brand. I don't know about this one. This might actually be a good omen for this upcoming weekend if everything is going to go not according to plan, because according to Vegas's plan, the Packers are not supposed to win this next game in the state of California against the 49ers. But there was a game against the Seattle Seahawks, and I'm feeling pretty good still. Victory Monday, as we record this, it is, and it was a glorious day indeed.
Glorious day indeed. Sea hags, shit bags, whatever you want to call them. I love them all. But yeah, the Seahawks are done. It's gone. It's over with. I will say this before we get going too much. If the Packers never play Russell Wilson in a playoff game again, it will be too soon. That guy is, right. And I make fun of him a lot, and he gives me a lot of material to do so. He's corny as all hell, but he is a great quarterback and great with a capital G. Speaking of great, my other co-host of this night, we have Paul Brettle here. Paul of Dairyland Express, Cheesehead TV, the internet, basically, when it comes to covering the Packers, and now of Pulse of the Pack. So Paul is here, ready to talk some Green Bay Packers. Paul, how was the view from home yesterday?
It was fantastic. Always better with the win. And just think back to where we were this time a year ago. LaFleur just been hired. We're in off-season mode, looking at free agents in the draft. Now we're coming off a divisional round win. We got the NFC Championship ahead. Life is good.
Yeah, let's start there too, because that really is a great transition of this time a year ago. Matt LaFleur was hired on January 7th a year ago, the day after the double doink. That's how I remember it. It's also my dad's birthday, so maybe I should remember it that way. But Matt LaFleur was hired then, and literally coming off of a season where the Packers finished 6-9-1, and frankly, it wasn't. The Packers didn't even feel like a six-win team. And now maybe that's because we're spoiled because the Packers have been so good for the better part of two decades, but they really didn't feel like they were a good team. There was some really bad press, some bad news surrounding the quarterback, some stories that were written that came later in the offseason about how Rodgers and LaFleur aren't getting along, and is Rodgers, did they hire a buddy instead of a coach, and how's Rodgers going to take to that? How is the franchise going to take to this new locker room? There's all these changes. Clay Matthews is gone. Jordy's gone. Cobb's gone. Now some new faces and new places. And 1 year later, the Packers are playing for the right to go to the Super Bowl. And before we even get to that, actually, I missed something. If you go back to preseason predictions, Paul, Jason, we talked about it one of the last times we were together, and I think Paul had them 11-5 and losing in the divisional round, if memory serves. Jason had them making the playoffs at 10-6, winning a wild card game, losing in the divisional round. And I didn't even have Green Bay making the playoffs. I had them 9-7 and just missing out. And I even said in the preseason show that we did together that to me would be considered a positive because they haven't won a lot around here recently, very recently, I should say. And getting back to having a winning record, establishing that culture, everything like that, it just wasn't something that was feasible to me for them to be as good as they were. Now, I did acknowledge the upside, but I figured first-year head coach, a lot of first-year players on the defense, some unknowns on the defense, and they've all hit. It's crazy to think, because if you had told me they signed four free agents, I'd have told you two of them are probably really good and two of them are probably disappointing. All four of those guys have lived up to expectations in terms of their free agents. The draft has some stuff that I don't want to see leaves to be desired. There just haven't been a lot of immediate contributors, save for Elgton Jenkins and Darnell Savage. Some guys are playing roles like Rashawn Gary and Jay Sternberger. But Jason, just how surreal, because that's something I was reflecting on a little bit last night, and I tend to romanticize, especially after playoff games, and that's especially true after the last home game of the season, just because I know it'll be a while before I'm back up there again. How crazy, how surreal, how whatever superlative you want to use is it to think that a year ago this team was in the dumpster? Like, Terrell Davis picking the Packers to finish 6-10, I know it's a major mocking talking point now. At the time, I don't think that was that unrealistic to think that that was a possibility. How crazy is it to think that this team not only has surpassed those expectations, but now, like you said, Vegas doesn't give them a whole hell of a lot of a chance, but has an opportunity. They're one of, by the time that game kicks, there will be one of three teams left that can win a Super Bowl.
It's crazy to come this far. I mean, I had them basically getting to last night and not getting past it, which for a minute it looked like maybe that could possibly happen. But the way the Packers finished out that game, and I'm telling you, I mean, at this point right now, if you're asking me right now, that's why I kind of got into it with some fans about the expectations about this team and how, you know, people who are getting a little testy and feisty about the Packers not looking great going into the playoffs is because those expectations got recalibrated constantly throughout the season. And by the time they won their 10th, 11th game, well, you know, at that point, you can't really call them, as was popularly thrown around this past week, fraudulent and not good, because they're winning games. They're figuring out how to win games. And lo and behold, like I said, Paul, I think we talked about it on Pack a Day on Saturday, and Jake, we talked about this last week. The things that got you there are going to be what manifest themselves in the playoffs. So today, right now, this team is I'll tell you this right now, the 2019 Green Bay Packers will absolutely not underachieve. Nope. You know, that's a good thing. That's a very good thing, because that's disappointing when your team leaves things out on the field. They will not underachieve. Go back to when we made these predictions and when we first started talking about that, to know that they're going to get to the NFC Championship game. I want to know what at that point, because when we did that show, they were getting ready to head into week one. The roster was pretty much set. Mm-hmm. So what I want to know is, you know, if I'm putting myself back in early September, is who did we trade for midseason? Because we clearly had to make a move midseason. If we're the, you know, who, what, you know, quote unquote Khalil Mack type, or, you know, at this point now, another Za'Darius Smith or whatever, you know, did, you know, Jordy like go get in the cryogenic for, you know, chamber and come back, you know, 10 years younger? Like, what happened? And for this roster to have gotten to this point, huge, huge testament to Brian Gutekunst, who I think it was on Monday, Ryan Wood said, how, if he hasn't locked up executive of the year after yesterday's win over the Seahawks, I don't know. And then the job that Matt LaFleur and his staff have done in just their first year, I mean, they're setting a really tough bar for themselves for the seasons to come. I can tell you that, but I'll take that problem any day.
Yeah, good problem to have. I think you said the Packers will not underachieve. I also think they could have lost yesterday, and that would be factual as well. This team has overachieved from what anybody except for James Jones expected. And, you know, you mentioned some of the roster and stuff like that. I think, you know, all of us kind of had some expectations for Za'Darius and Preston, but I'm telling you, none of us expected this. I don't think it's smart or whatever. I mean, whatever word you want to use to call it, to have expected this out of those two guys. They've been, Za'Darius Smith is an all-pro player. He may not have made the all-pro team. As he told you yesterday, he was snubbed with his shirt. I thought that was awesome. He's a great player. He's completely changed the locker room, but it's been incredible to watch this team overachieve. Because like I said, that's not something I expected. Paul, I mean, you kind of brought up a year ago at this point in time, if I had told you on January 13th of 2019 that, hey, that team, that you know has just hired a new head coach. I'm going to fast forward for you a little bit and tell you they're going to sign two pass rushers in free agency that are going to completely change the locker room. They're going to sign a safety that's assignment sure and makes a couple plays here or there, and they're going to get a starting guard that's average to above average and helps solidify some of that stuff on the offensive line. Oh, and by the way, they're going to not only win the division, they're going to sweep the division. They're going to go 13-3, which is their best record since 2011. And they're going to get a first-round bye, beat the Seattle Seahawks in a playoff game, and have a chance to play the 49ers to go to the Super Bowl. What are you telling me at that point in time?
I would have told you to switch off rookie mode on Madden, maybe do something a little more difficult than that. it's been incredible, the turnaround. And, you know, like you guys mentioned, the free agents, they've all been as advertised and even more so. It means Zadarius, the second that his foot hit down in Green Bay, he's just engulfed himself in this team and made himself a leader. What Matt LaFleur has done, and then Brian Gutekunst going out, and my biggest takeaway from this season is how they can win different ways. You know, for so long it was what can Aaron Rodgers do, you know, but we've seen the defense win games. We've seen Aaron Jones carry them to victories. Last night we saw Aaron Rodgers and Davante Adams, like the good old days, carry this offense. So that's my biggest takeaway, and it's just top to bottom. It's the efforts in the locker room, off the field, the players that they brought in. I mean, even the midseason acquisitions, that Tyler Irvin and Jared Valdir, like everything has just come together this season. And also it's a special group of guys, and I think that goes with the off the field and in the locker room stuff, but they are resilient. You know, you can talk about winning ugly, as a lot of people like to do, but winning's difficult in the NFL, even if it's not pretty like the Ravens and Saints do, as everyone.
What time do they play on Sunday?
Exactly, as everyone's so happy to point out. But the way that they can just, they get the stops like they always do. I tweeted that last night before that final Seahawks drive. I said the defense is somehow, in the big moments they've come up, whether it's been a sack or a turnover, they've done it all year. What happens? Third down, Preston Smith takes down Russell Wilson. They're just a resilient group. They're having fun. And most importantly, they know how to win, regardless of what numbers say.
Yeah, I love the Preston Smith sack dance, by the way, the pounding of the ground and the screaming. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to emulate, first of all, for somebody like me who's not that athletic. But I seem to catch myself doing that in public pretty often if I am watching a highlight or see something like that. But it's a lot of fun. And, Paul, I mean, we didn't plan this for you to segue like this for me, but it's worked out perfectly. But I think one of the big storylines yesterday is some of those on-the-margin pickups from Brian Gutekunst, because Tyler Irvin had a couple nice plays. Obviously, he was primarily a return man. I thought he was going to score on his second carry when they ran that little reverse to him. But really, the big story of this game, and really the last two games that the Packers have played, is Jared Veld here, because this is a guy who, Alex Light, with all due respect, he's not ready for prime time. He played poorly against the Eagles. He was a tire fire against the 49ers. Now, to give him some credit, Jason seems to like the phrasing of tire fire or something like that. To some of his credit, he is a young player. Nick Bosa, trust me, that family exists to give me nightmares, so I know that. And he's very good, and Brandon Graham and that Eagles front is very good. That being said, when Brian Bulaga yesterday, it was reported he was questionable with an illness. And then he was active, but he didn't start, which was kind of strange, because he went through warmups and everything like that, but it sounds like they just got him on the field and he just wasn't able to go. And that's unfortunate, but Bulaga had exited the Detroit game 2 weeks prior with a concussion, and the Packers were trailing at the time that he exited the game. Veld here held up. He did his end of the bargain, and I can tell you that Green Bay probably doesn't win if Alex Light plays against Detroit. And they definitely, I don't think, win yesterday if Alex Light is playing right tackle. Seattle's front isn't great, but if you're playing a young, below-average offensive tackle, they can trick you some. Paul, you brought him up. I mean, I said today on Twitter, I don't think it can be understated how big of a pickup that is that Jared Veld here has been, because most teams don't have two good offensive tackles. And it looks like right now Green Bay has three. And that is such a blessing, because we've seen it in past years when Bulaga couldn't go. It was Josh Walker or Don Barclay or Alex Light. You know, name your fringe NFL starter playing right tackle. And more often than not, it was a disaster. And now it's not a disaster. Not only is it not a disaster, it's actually a net positive because Jared Valdir did not allow a single quarterback pressure yesterday. And there were times that you could tell Seattle was trying to match up Jadeveon Clowney with him as here's your test. How big has 68 been for this team? And how confident are you in him if he has to play against Bosa next Sunday?
Yeah, he's been an incredible pickup. And after I saw your tweet this afternoon, I went to Pro Football Focus and looked. And in the Lions game and in last night in the 58 pass blocking snaps that he hasn't allowed a single hit, hurry, or sack. And he doesn't even have a penalty yet. And for a guy that was retired, you know, a little over a month ago or about a month ago, that's incredibly impressive. And then also I want to tip the cap to Brian Gutekunst for going out and putting a claim in on him to get him on the team because tackles are premier position in this league. Like you said, very few teams even have two good tackles. The Packers have been fortunate, and we've been spoiled as fans that they've had one of the best or the best duo for a number of years now at that position. And like I mentioned earlier, they can win in multiple ways with the defense, Aaron Jones, all that. But the name of the game is still keeping Aaron Rodgers upright. And that's always going to be a key to success for the Packers or any NFL team for that matter, keeping their quarterback upright, and Valdir has done a fantastic job. And then just to transition a little to Tyler Irvin, you know, this Packers punt return team was one of the worst, or they were on a historically bad pace in terms of return yardage. He quickly turned that around from his first game, but also what he's brought offensively. You know, it's a new wrinkle that teams have to prepare for now. Mm-hmm. And both of them have just been fantastic additions to this team.
And I give Matt LaFleur a lot of credit for working Irvin in. You know, a lot of coaches, especially ones that have been here in the past, for somebody who got here late would say, well, you don't know the offense, you don't get on the field. And I'm not trying to dig up dirty laundry. Like I said, I've supported that previous coach quite a bit. That's just the reality of how it is. If a player like that were brought in, he would have been glued to the bench and never brought in on offense. And Irvin has been more than that. You could see it. With all due respect to Jamal Williams, he's a good player. Tyler Irvin's more explosive than he is.
And absolutely.
Explosive players on offense are what you're looking for. For those of you that are watching the national championship game, both teams have like 10 of those guys. The only one who's not explosive on the field is one of the offensive linemen, and he probably is too. But other than that, everybody on these offenses can play. And Irvin's had that ability to do that as well. Jason, this is something that hasn't been a big thing in the past, bringing in guys on the margins like that. Just how encouraging is it that Brian Gutekunst is willing to make plays like that? Because in the past, I can promise you, Ted Thompson, again, great, does things a little differently, but I can promise you he wouldn't have claimed Jared Valdir because he would have said, we've got Alex and we've got Yash, who we like on the practice squad.
Yeah, and it's like I mentioned earlier about Goot and his candidacy for Executive of the Year. You know, these are the kind of things that you do to help your just kind of push your team forward continuously and not giving up just because the trade deadline is passed or, you know, free agency is over with, or, you know, there's other options and other opportunities out there for you to make your team better. Now, Brian Bulaga is active in an absolute pinch. And if they're screwed for some reason, he could have gone in. Maybe he's in uniform. But the other benefit is he didn't have to play a single snap last night, so he essentially gets a second week of rest. You know, yes, he was sick, but this is a guy who had a head injury, and he's probably – listen, he's an offensive line. He's had, you know, a finger injury, you know, a gnarly finger injury. He's probably had a shoulder, knee, hips. All those things are healing one more week, and that's only going to – you assume that, you know, hopefully this bug that's going on in the locker room is going to dissipate at some point. Everyone's going to get better, you know. That's going to put them in a really good spot for the most important game on their season, which is the next game. And it does happen to be the most important game of the season for all the two teams. So it's massive. It's absolutely massive. And it's one of the reasons why this team is where they're at so quickly. You know, this is Goot's third season at the helm. Second season at the helm of the team. Well, and you know, I know that his involvement increased a little bit before Ted left, but we don't know all the ins and outs of what he actually was involved with or controlling. So, you know, when you think about some of the moves that he's made, we talked about it. You know, he shook everything up with the Jordy release, and then from there, you know, it was off to the races, the draft and everything else. But it's massive, you know, and Valdir, of course, obviously, you know, all the linemen played special teams too, but, you know, that's a guy who can step in. And think about this, Alec, you know, blocking on special teams, I don't know anything about it specifically, but those are fast guys that are trying to make a play, and the Seahawks have notoriously been sneaky on special teams. If you've got an Alex Light out there, how do you know that he doesn't let his guy get an extra half a step and all of a sudden you've got a block kick or something like that? So all those little things absolutely matter. They're huge when you put them under the microscope.
Yeah, and we can even go back to some of the guys in the offseason. Chandon Sullivan is one of those on-the-margin types. He's been phenomenal through most of the year in his little hybrid defensive back role. Ibrahim Campbell is another example of a player like that. B.J. Goodson hasn't lit the world on fire. I'm not saying he's Luke Kuechly, but he's played a role and played it relatively well.
Well, B.J. Goodson is also now apparently our second kick returner, which is very encouraging.
Well, I mean, it wasn't Lucas Patrick, so that was a positive. Although, as he's returning that kick, all I'm saying is just don't freaking fumble, because I can totally picture that game turning on that. Speaking of the game, there was one played, so maybe we should talk about that too. And obviously, some of those stories we got to a little bit. The start is really what it has been all year for the Packers, save for a few games here or there. They start fast. They go right down the field. A really big mix of Aaron Jones, Davante Adams, and Jimmy Graham. And the throw from Rodgers was one of those. This is how I knew right away it was going to be a bit of a vintage night for him, because it's a third down, and they've completed one to Jimmy Graham. But then it's another third and seven, and Rodgers lets it go, and I could see him start to fade back, and you could just tell it was right on the money. And it was one of those, when it left his hand, you were like, touchdown. And even though that hasn't really been the case a lot of the times this season, when he lets it go, you're almost like, where's it going? You know, kind of thing. Right on the money. Green Bay starts fast. It's 7-0. And then the subsequent possession should have resulted in a fumble recovered by Chandon Sullivan, as I just mentioned him. And it didn't. I don't understand why the officials blew the play dead. I don't understand how they said that there was no clear visual evidence that Sullivan didn't recover the ball, but that's beside the point. Green Bay had to play on. Seattle ended up punting at any rate. And Green Bay kind of took over from there. I mean, it got to 7-3 at one point, but then a mix of Rodgers and Adams and Jimmy Graham. And I really want to get to him as well. I think it's a story that Graham had three catches. They were all on third down. We'll get to the big one later, but the first two really did kind of help turn the tide in some of these games early, because the Packers, if they kick a field goal, like, cool, yeah, you kicked a field goal early in the game, but it just doesn't have the same impact. And then later in the game, he gets a touchdown, or they convert a third down with him and get to a touchdown. Paul, you sent out a tweet on some of the stats of Seattle's inability to cover the tight end, and wondered if Jimmy Graham could be an X factor or something, or have a bit of a big day. And I'll admit it, I kind of laughed, because it's like, well, this would be the game that Jimmy Graham doesn't show up at all and do anything, because that's just kind of how it's been for most of the year. So, I mean, what was your level of surprise when you found out that Graham, I mean, he only had three catches, but they were all quality catches and all big on third down. And I think that that's what the Packers, when they signed him, I don't think they were thinking they were getting New Orleans Jimmy Graham, who's going to dominate a game, but can they get somebody who can be a target for Rodgers on third down, a veteran player who's kind of been through some of these wars before? But what was your level of surprise? Were you surprised to see him do as well as he did?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I was. I tweeted out and I did an article on how the tight ends for the Packers had a great opportunity against the Seattle defense this week, just because they've struggled all season. They've been one of the worst teams in guarding tight ends in terms of catches they've allowed per game, yards per catch, total yards allowed per game. So, and I ended the article with the opportunities there, but will they take advantage of it? Because obviously I didn't know, because Jimmy Graham has been disappointing. Like you said, he's lost this step, which isn't a surprise, but even in the red zone, he's had some drops against the Lions on that opening play, kind of turned the tide in a negative fashion for the game. He had that drop as well, but last night he was fantastic. He only had four targets, but like you said, he had three catches, all of them on third down, all of them converted the third down. And he was awesome. He was exactly what they needed. And he was exactly – that was the Jimmy Graham I think we all kind of envisioned when he was signed last year, and the guy that we were hoping that the Packers would have. And, hey, if he's peaking right now at the right time, I'll surely take it.
Yeah, I will as well. I mean, those were big plays early in the game. The first one really, I think, was able to – because what does Green Bay do? I think something that we've kind of talked about as a whole before is Green Bay plays really well. There's 16 minutes in the game, I think, where they've played really well. And that's the first 4 minutes of the game, the last 4 minutes of the half, the first 4 minutes of the third quarter, and the last 4 minutes of the fourth quarter. And that's a big reason that they've been as good as they have. Well, part of that is scoring touchdowns early. And you have to score touchdowns because Seattle, as you can see, didn't. They kicked a field goal in the first half. They missed a field goal late in the first half that allowed the Packers to have a chance to go up 21-3. Something that I found interesting about this game was that Seattle took away Aaron Jones for the most part, because we talked about this pre-show that when he had that first run and he rips it off for 25 yards, I'm sitting there thinking to myself, okay, he's about to go for $175 and three touchdowns and just dominate this game. Not the case. He did have the two touchdowns, both of which obviously were big ones. Touchdowns are never a bad thing to score. Surprise, surprise. But his final stat line to get through the end of the day was 21 carries, 62 yards, and one of those carries was for 23 yards. So kind of tough sledding. 3 yards a crack. Just interesting that it worked out the way that it did. Jason, were you surprised? Because when we talked about this game, we really did peg it as this is an Aaron Jones game. This is Aaron Jones's time to shine. Packers are a bit of a running team, want to run the ball anyways. The elements, the cold, all that stuff, although there weren't very many elements as the game started. What was your surprise level that Jones didn't? He had a good game. I'm not going to say he didn't, but that he didn't dominate the way that maybe it looked like he was going to after the first possession.
It was surprising. It was an adjustment Seattle made. I mean, you can't say the Packers didn't continue to try to work it. You know, they 17 of their attempts came in the first half, and the Packers only had 16 rushing yards in the entire second half. They only tried to run it 8 times. And a lot of that was also a factor of them not having possessed the ball much in the second half either. And I think, you know, I keep going back to the same old cliche here, go with what got you here. And Aaron Jones is absolutely one of the things that got the Packers here. But over the past decade, the thing that's gotten the Packers to where they're at right now is the quarterback. And the Packers chose to put the ball in his hands, and obviously it paid off. So it was good to see, you know, and I think this puts in the mind of the Packers and their opponents, you know, whatever may be in front of them. Obviously, it's the 49ers this week. And then if we're beyond fortunate to have another game after that, think about, man, if Aaron Jones doesn't go off, this team can still win games. So I would have liked to have seen him be more productive. But honestly, if you're going to score 2 touchdowns on that kind of a day, you get in the end zone twice. That's kind of what Aaron Jones has done. He scored a ton of touchdowns. I mean, he was pushing for a Packers record at one point this season. So, I mean, do we, you know, are we upset if, you know, he doesn't break 1,000 yards, you know, if he only has like an 800 yard season, for example, but you know, he ends up with the touchdown record, because that's the name of the game really. So, I mean, it was surprising just because of the way he started, but you know, I don't have any issue believing that even if that's the case, the Packers can't figure out how to overcome it. It's just the adjustments in the game have been such a nice, refreshing change. And I shouldn't even say the adjustments, because they've always been made every year with you know, even under Mike McCarthy, but they're working. And that's you know, they're working and they're really succeeding, and that's what's very refreshing after the last 2 seasons.
I also just want to add, too, on Aaron Jones, because going into the game, I thought it was going to be a big one for him as well. Seattle's last 5, they've given up 160 rushing yards on the ground per average over those games. But I think they just made it an effort that we're eliminating him from the game. We'll let our secondary, who forces a lot of turnovers, take on the Packers receivers and Rodgers, who have been inconsistent this season. And I think that all showed their attention on Jones. I saw that, I can't remember who tweeted it out, but it was a clip from the game. And it was a play action. Jones goes to the left side. The defensive line, the linebackers, they all crash towards that left guard, left tackle. And the middle of the field just opens up like the sea. And Rodgers hits Davante Adams, I believe it was, going across. So I think, and credit to Seattle, they did a fantastic job in taking him away. But I think that was their main focus for it. And then I mentioned this when we were getting ready for the show, I still love how Matt LaFleur gave him 21 rushing attempts, despite it being tough sledding. We saw earlier in the year that they would get away from that early if things were tough for Jones, but they kept giving him the ball, and that's what you need to do, even if it's struggling. You know, he's a focal point. He's a main point of this offense, and they got to get him the ball, even if it's, you know, tough sledding at times.
Yeah, the RPO that you're talking about from Jones to Devontae, it was kind of funny because then Rodgers shrugs to the sideline like, okay, if you're going to give that to me, then I'll take it. You know, no big deal there. We mentioned the second half and the lack of possessions. Green Bay had four possessions in the second half. They scored a touchdown. They punted twice. They moved the ball. They went three and out once, but they moved the ball to midfield on one of those plays. That drive ended in a sack before they punted. And then the last drive, of course, where they had two big third down conversions and kneeled out the clock, which we'll get to here in a little bit. But speaking of the clock, something that I was incredibly impressed with, and if you look at it going into Sunday or Saturday and Sunday, I think the coach that was the most under the microscope was Matt LaFleur. And that's just kind of the nature of the job that he took. When you coach the most talented player or one of the most talented players in all of the sport, and the narrative is that this player is being wasted, quote unquote, which is stupid, but that is the narrative. That's just the nature of the job. It's not uncommon. It's not unlike when you are the coach of LeBron James. If LeBron James's NBA team doesn't win, his teammates suck, his coaches suck, whatever. But that's typically how that's worked for the Packers as well. We blame the defense. We blame the receivers. He doesn't have a running game. Mike McCarthy's a moron, whatever. Dom Capers sucks, whatever it is. I think everything LaFleur did this weekend was going to come under a microscope, especially if Green Bay lost, because it's a home playoff game. Even though it was his first playoff game, it's not like there's a ton of time left for Aaron Rodgers to be playing in games like these. And I thought the plan was very good. I thought, based on some of the stuff that I've seen that he's called, he was creative. His route combinations were good. But the one thing, and I kind of made this joke in a story that's going to come out for Packer Report, is that anybody who plays Madden thinks they can manage the clock. So that's like the one thing that everybody is criticizing a coach for. And it doesn't, there's an old tweet where it's like, it takes from every one of the fan bases and says, nobody thinks their head coach can manage the clock, basically. Well, at the end of the first half yesterday, Green Bay gets to the 2-minute warning. They're facing a third and one. And Rodgers runs a quarterback sneak, which I couldn't remember, but I thought it was for the first time since 2014, where he snuck one in against Detroit for a touchdown. If there has been another one since, I can't remember it. But he runs for a first down. Seattle calls a timeout. That was their first. LaFleur runs the ball twice, gets Seattle to call their timeouts. Plays that could score, but at minimum forces Seattle to call a timeout, and a high percentage play that you can still have, you know, you only have to get a yard or 2 yards or something like that, instead of where you call a pass play and maybe you get sacked kind of thing. So we have that. And then the clock runs down, and Green Bay scores eventually with a minute and 22 seconds left, or, well, a little over a minute 22 left. By the time Seattle returns the kickoff, they have the ball with a minute 22 and no timeouts left. They snap the ball. They get tackled in bounds. There's 57 seconds left by the time they throw a pass that gets them out of bounds to DK Metcalf. Kenny Clark sacks Russell Wilson, and then Wilson runs a quarterback draw on third and nine or something like that. Slides for a first down. They clock the ball with 10 seconds left. 47 seconds elapsed, and Seattle ran two plays of consequence and had to chuck a Hail Mary at the end of the half. And that was because of the way that LaFleur trusted his guys, one, not only to score, but two, he ran plays to make Seattle use their timeouts. Now, I'm not saying they weren't trying to score, but it allowed them to have the opportunity to get Seattle to burn those timeouts. Because if you think about it, if Seattle has a timeout left, they can burn one after Russ gets sacked by Kenny Clark, and they probably save 40 or so of those 47 seconds I just mentioned. That saved anywhere from 3 to 7 points. Russell Wilson in two-minute drill, scramble drill type stuff is terrifying. And you saw that pretty much the whole second half, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I thought that was masterful. It saves anywhere from 3 to 7 points. And the final score was 28 to 23. So if he saved 7 points, I'm sure you guys can do the math. Matt LaFleur was awesome yesterday. And I've been trying to keep a level head, because I think that there are times where we say we like things that change for the sake of they're different. And I also think that there were things that we could learn throughout the course of the year about Matt LaFleur that we may not know prior. Does he get better when he makes mistakes? And I think the answer to that question is yes. The Philadelphia game is a very good example. He made a mistake or several in those games, and he's learned from those. God damn, he was good yesterday. And I can't, I'm still trying to temper my expectations as much as possible, but I think he has been as close to a home run hire as you can call it, because like I said, he's under this huge microscope and calls maybe his best game of the year. The culture has completely changed and he's been phenomenal. There's really no other way to put that. And I think he was at his best yesterday, and he's going to need to be at his best next week because Green Bay has a tough challenge ahead of them. But what did you, had you guys even considered some of that sequence at the end of the half? I don't know if that was something that you guys had talked about. Jason, what were your thoughts on, you know, kind of LaFleur's clock management, or maybe not that specifically, but his game management as a whole yesterday?
It was good. It was excellent. And there's been questions this season. He's had some bumps, but he was great. And I, you know, to be honest with you, that was at the end of the first half. So it's like, okay, I'm not as aware of how great it's going to be, but that obviously set the table for the rest of the game. And one of the things that everyone talks about is preparing the game plan and the offense and the play calls and what are you going to do and how are you going to defend this look and how are you going to take advantage of this defensive formation. But the one thing that we don't think about is the coaches have to prepare for in-game situations and clock management and what are you going to do. And when you look at some of the teams that are still playing right now, apparently Mike Vrabel is managing the clock as just as good as any other coach in the NFL right now, and that's one of the reasons why his old boss is at home. You know, I mean, it's in that, and he learned from the best in Bill Belichick. And those are the types of things that those guys do to keep, to give their teams a chance to win. And it's about damn time the Packers have a guy like that. You know, somebody who's willing to do those things. I think, you know, when you, we can only compare to what we have had before, it's a huge step forward. You know, Mike McCarthy was a great game manager and he called great offenses and he had great, great moments in time in Green Bay. You know, but those types of things are the little, those are the little things that help you win a one possession game. And that's exactly what the Packers did. You know, you mentioned saving him 7 points. You know, everybody's going to look at the play on the field and, you know, and talk about the interception that Kevin King dropped, and then Seattle goes down and kick a field goal. So that's 3 points on the board there that could have potentially gone away. But that's a good catch there in that the head coach and being aware and paying attention in those situations, you know, no better time to be peaking in that sense on the coaching level and on the player level than right now. It was a great game. Great time for everybody to come with their best, for sure.
Yeah, and it's a spot where, I mean, that was something that was discussed, that Green Bay might have had a big disadvantage in, that Matt LaFleur was coaching his first ever playoff game, whereas Pete Carroll is, has a borderline Hall of Fame resume. He's coached in 2 Super Bowls and had an, he's won one, and I mean, they've been through a lot of wars with Pete Carroll there in Seattle, and they're going to need that. I mean, going forward here for the next, if they're fortunate enough to play 2 games, you're going to be facing off against Kyle Shanahan, who's a very good coach. And then in the Super Bowl, either Andy Reid or Mike Vrabel. Neither one of those guys is an easy guy to prepare for. So it's good to see LaFleur doing things like that. Paul, very briefly, because we got to get to the second half here at some point, but what were your thoughts on the way LaFleur managed the game yesterday?
I thought he did a great job, as you know, for the reasons that you brought up. And before the game, I think I was talking to Jason on the Packaday podcast. I thought that LaFleur had, while the execution wasn't always there by the offense, his play calling from the Vikings game and the Detroit game, I thought were very, very good. It was, you know, kind of like your players, you want them to ramp up and peak during the postseason. I thought he was at that point from a play calling standpoint. And then, you know, that's a great observation on your point with how he managed the clock at the end of the half, but also scoring inside the 5-yard line on those 2 possessions. In the past, those have been areas, and even earlier in the season.
Oh, and Paul, I don't want to stop you, but I know every single person in the stands was thinking about Mike McCarthy kicking 2 field goals inside the 2.
Yes. So everyone knows what,
think about that.
Yes, so everyone knows what I'm referring to. But just the trust that he has in his guys, the plays that he dialed up, and earlier I mentioned sticking with Aaron Jones. He stuck with Aaron Jones down there. There were a number of, you know, first down goes by, second down goes by, and I'm waiting for them to pass the ball, and he just kept feeding Aaron Jones for the most part. I think that just shows how he's evolved as a coach, because remember earlier in the season they got stuffed on the 1 yard line, I think in Philly and in Dallas on back to back games. Yep. So the adjustments that he's made throughout the season, the fact that this team has never lost two games in a row this season, and they won't, regardless of how it ends, you know, that's all a reflection of him and his play calling, you know, his philosophy, implementing it, and him learning as a coach as well, because obviously this isn't easy, but, you know, he's made it look pretty easy, and the players obviously love him.
Yeah, game management, team management, everything. You could tell, I mean, you could tell more and more that Matt LaFleur is the right hire with just the way that everything's gone. He's come in, and you could see, I mean, players were supportive of Mike McCarthy when he got hired by Dallas, and vocal, Devontae Adams, Tremont Williams, a lot of players. But you could tell that it was just time to try something different. And Matt LaFleur, to his credit, has been different. He's given the players ownership, and that's been a huge thing, something I'm sure we'll talk about a lot when the end of the season, off-season stuff hits, because really I think his biggest victory, and I wrote this mid-season for Packer Report, was that the culture of the locker room has changed. You know, last year I remember, it's small stuff, but it's stuff that eventually adds up to bigger annoyances. You know, Aaron Nagler tweets out, "Just punt on third down," and Devontae Adams likes that tweet. And it's one of those, it's a small thing. It's not a huge deal, but it's something that you can kind of show some cracks in the foundation. Rodgers criticizes McCarthy openly after that game, something that he'd been passive aggressive in the past, but this was full on aggression. Players being insubordinate, Ty Montgomery running out of the end zone when he was told, just small stuff like that. Well, that was kind of a big one, but stuff like that, that adds up to a bad team now being a very good team. And this locker room is completely bought in. They're all in on stuff. You know, Aaron Rodgers, one of his criticisms, fair or not, I tend to lean toward the not side of things, but is that he didn't care about winning. He only cared about his stats. And I don't think that's the case. I think that you could tell his stat lines have been, I don't want to say pedestrian, but not high level to what we've come accustomed to with Aaron Rodgers. And he says he doesn't care. He's all about winning. He's at the stage of his career where it's just about winning. And the Packers have done quite a bit of that. And they had to do that yesterday because the second half, it's 21-3. Seattle comes out. They go down the field and they end up scoring a touchdown to make it 21-10. And you could kind of get a sense, I was in the stadium yesterday, of, oh boy, here we go again with those kinds of things. Conjuring up some memories from the ghosts of NFC playoffs past, if you will. Green Bay, to their credit, came right back. I thought LaFleur was excellent coming out of the half. There was a pitch to Tyler Irvin that I thought he was going to score on. And then they kind of stuck with their play-action passing game and were able to hit Devontae Adams. Adams shook his defender out of his shoes and ran to the end zone. And bang, it's 28-10, just like that. Seattle, to their credit, though, this is where some opinions may differ. Because a lot of people are thinking like, okay, Green Bay kind of fell asleep at the wheel, took their foot off the gas, whatever your words want to be. Here's where I give the Seahawks credit, and I hate them. I have made no bones about that. I think Russell Wilson's corny. I think Pete Carroll is a scumbag, all those things. Yeah, that was probably a little harsh, but whatever. To their credit, they are a resilient team, and they never quit. They're very similar to the Packers in that regard. I think the Packers have more talent, and that's why they're 13-3, whereas Seattle finished 11-5 and was playing on the road. The Packers are a very resilient team, much like the Seahawks, and I think Seattle, something else about this game, it was kind of funny because I was talking about this with Peter Bukowski of Locked On Packers, and it was like, you know, when they took that big lead, it was almost like you'd prefer it be a closer game throughout because then Seattle's going to hand it to a washed-up Marshawn Lynch and an undrafted free agent in Travis Homer, whereas now they're down 18 with a little over 25 minutes to play, and they've just got to let Russell Wilson do Russell Wilson things, which is when they're at their best. Seattle's unwillingness to play through their quarterback will never cease to amaze me. But I don't think this was a collapse. I think you really did look at just Seattle making great plays. Russell Wilson doing Russell Wilson things, making amazing plays down the stretch. He was under duress. Green Bay was probably like 10 feet total away from having 10 sacks. They still finished with 5, and they could have had a lot more. But I think he just made some plays down the stretch. It's hard to defend a guy like that who can kind of scramble and go around like stuff like that. Green Bay was trying to prevent some big plays. I would have liked to have seen them be a little more aggressive, But I think overall that was their goal, was to make it so Seattle can't make it 28-17 and 28-24. Excuse me, 28-24 within a matter of minutes. Now, Jason, I know how you are. So your thought process yesterday, did you think this was a team who kind of fell asleep at the wheel and got a little too comfortable?
Well, if you were following me on Twitter, yes. I mean, I didn't like the way the defense wasn't stepping up there, but obviously the thing that's happening is when you have to defend a guy like Russell Wilson and then you've got Tyler Lockett and guys that have a lot of speed, it's going to wear you out. So the defense was tired. I mean, they were just really tired. If you look at the snap counts, you know, most of the starters played the entire game. So you got guys that are out there for 3 hours. It's you know, those of you who've played football, even if you didn't start, you know, it's a grueling game. You know, practice is hard to get through sometimes. So they were gassed. It looked bleak, but there's an air about this team that just tells you, listen, it's going to be a little bit different. At least it wasn't the ominous, hey, this is going to fall apart and we're in trouble right now. You know, there's a chance that they're going to step up and make a play, or Zadarius or Preston are going to get another sack. And, you know, this is the time that your stars need to shine. And they did. And it's a home game, and there's just little clues to the confidence level that this team has and the way that they get some things done. So it wasn't totally surprising that they came out of it okay. You know, I still felt like if Pete Carroll doesn't make the absolutely baffling decision to punt at the end of the game there, which was I give Pete Carroll a lot of crap because I'm an ASU Sun Devil. You know, that's my alma mater. I'm an alumni. So when he was at USC, I hated him then. Then he comes to the Seattle Seahawks and all the things that have happened over the last 10 years. Pete Carroll's not my favorite person on earth, but he gave us one yesterday, you know. But
let's talk about that then, actually, because I think that's a good point, because there were about 4 minutes left in the game. Seattle's on their own side of the 50. Mm-hmm. I actually thought that they played it well in punting because they had all of their timeouts and they got into situations that they wanted to be in. Green Bay had two big third downs. They just didn't make plays on those third downs. I think that at that point in time, if you don't punt and get it, you risk Green Bay scoring again, and now the game is absolutely completely over. Whereas if you punt, you play defense, you're going to get the ball back with, I mean, by the time they're using their timeouts, they had well over 2 minutes left if they had stopped Green Bay the first time around. I know that it's popular to think that punting is wrong, and there are more cases than not where, I mean, we can talk about after the Jimmy Graham play, I thought Green Bay should have gone for it. But on your own side of the 50 with that much time left, I think punting was the right move there. So, Jason, you don't? It was 4th and 11, mind you, after Preston Smith's sack.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the way that Pete Carroll explained it made it sound very, very – like a very easy call to make and a very easy decision to make. I just think that if there's one quarterback in this league, you know, among a few, and I mean like a very small handful – who can convert that and actually make that happen, Russell Wilson is among them.
Yeah.
And one way, shape, or form, somehow, you know, he's going to pull the rabbit out of the hat. So had they gone for it, even though it's 4th and 11, everybody else is like, oh, I love it. We've got this wrapped up. We're going to wrap it up on defense. I would have been kind of just very calmly standing there watching, waiting for whatever would have happened. I would have not been surprised either way, but they kicked the ball away, you know, but it's one of those things where you still feel like, okay, the Packers can't give the ball back to Russell Wilson with any amount of time.
Yep.
You know, because, and we did have to watch, you know, if you want to talk about exercising demons, which yesterday for me, just that whole narrative was not that. You know, the game a few years ago was a completely different situation and a completely different set of circumstances that is never going to be mitigated. But we did have to watch Russell Wilson actually throw a Hail Mary. And, you know, for him to have the ball in his hands for any amount of time, for any length of time, for any reason, you know, I mean, as long as there's air in his lungs, he can do something. So that's why, for me, it was, you know, I did have a little bit of that pit in my stomach. But I also, when I had it, said to myself, this is the divisional playoffs. At this point forward, you're only facing the elite of the elite teams. They're here for a reason. And the Seattle Seahawks were a team that up until a few weeks ago were contending for the number one seed and were seemingly in the driver's seat. They had beaten San Francisco. They handed San Fran their first loss. And until that Sunday night game against the Rams, Seattle was, you know, they were the you know, they controlled their destiny. They were the team to beat. Mm-hmm. So That's how quickly things can turn around. That's more of where I was coming from. You know, the defense was gassed. When you go back and you look at it, you know, my first thought was Jair getting beat on the touchdown there to Lockett. Okay, Lockett's a little handsy there, and he got savvy, and it didn't get called. You know, and I was thinking, well, Jair didn't really have a great game. But when you go back and you think about it, it's like he had the, you know, he had the hit that caused the fumble at the beginning that wasn't called. Yep. And then he also stuffs Russell Wilson on that two-point try, which that is not an easy thing to do. Russell, you know, that two-point stuff was huge, huge, huge. That's a huge play by Jair Alexander, and I've been saying all along, Paul can back me up on this. I'm waiting for Darnell Savage and Jair Alexander to make a huge play. It wasn't the pick six that I was hoping for, but Jair absolutely balled it out. So, you know what? I've got to knock it off, and I just have to believe at this point, and I got to stop with the negative Nelly because this defense is coming through time and time again, gassed or not.
Yeah, I remember thinking about it because as Russ started to kind of run around and do his thing late in the first half, I kind of started to see some of the players. I'm like, that's going to be a problem because later in the game, you know, what was it? Preston Smith described it as chasing a chicken without a fence or something like that. I mean, at some point that was going to be a problem of players just being tired because he runs around and Russell Wilson has this uncanny ability to run around like that and not get hit because every time you see a running quarterback, you hear, is that sustainable? I shouldn't say a running quarterback, a quarterback with the ability to run like Russell Wilson. Is that sustainable? Because one day he's going to get squared up and he's never been squared up. Or if he has, it hasn't been bad enough to knock him out of a game. So Paul, real quick, before we move forward, did you think Pete Carroll made the right decision to punt there after Preston Smith's sack?
Yeah, I think just given the situation, I just looked it up. They were at their 36 yard line. As you mentioned, it was 4th and 11 and they had 3 timeouts and the 2 minute warning. I do think that if it was maybe 4th and 5, I think just given the momentum that they have, and I think Seattle's usually a more aggressive team, they would have gone for it. But well, in that situation,
4th and 5, they're on their 40 instead of like Green Bay's not in field goal range automatically.
Right.
Because a field goal makes it to where it's what? It would be 31-23, and you have to get a full slate of scoring to tie the game.
Yep. So I think the sack was huge. I mean, even if Russell Wilson were to throw that away, they would have probably went for it, and obviously who knows how that would have turned out. But I think in the situation, Carroll made the right decision with essentially 4 timeouts with the 2 minute warning.
Yeah, okay, so there we have that. And after that, Seattle punts, and it's 28-23, and I said, Jason said it too, the same thing. I'm standing, Green Bay is coming towards me from where I was at that point, and all I said was don't give him the ball back because I have no desire to see Russell Wilson with a chance to win the game. Wilson's one of the best of the best. He's been great, and I have no desire to watch him break my heart because I'm pretty sure that's what would have happened. So Green Bay runs the ball twice, and they're faced with a 3rd and 9. And dial one up, Aaron Rodgers with a picture-perfect throw to Davante Adams. If you want one minor criticism on it, it's that Adams ran out of bounds. But I think that kind of with the way he caught the ball and his momentum and everything like that, I think that kind of carried him out of bounds. But it did give Seattle another free timeout to where they had to get another first down. That's where the series and this game gets quote-unquote controversial. And by controversial, I mean if you're a Vikings fan, a Bears fan, or somebody who just doesn't like the Packers and wants to say that the refs are on their side. Green Bay is facing a 3rd and 7. And Jimmy Graham redemption, I mentioned, we talked about his 2 catches earlier. His 3rd one was here, and it couldn't be at a better time. It was for a first down. The yellow line is not official. It was a first down. And there's been plenty of camera angles and pictures. And Davante Adams' Instagram story says, shut up, because they show where Jimmy's at. And it clinches the game. And it's one of those before the play, I'm thinking, okay, so Seattle had called. I think Seattle had called their last timeout or something like that to where they didn't have – or Green Bay had a chance to talk about it. And I'm thinking like, okay, draw one up. Davante Adams, Aaron Jones, somebody like that. And Jimmy Graham was the primary, not only the primary read, but made the play. And too often during his time in Green Bay, those plays haven't been made. They've been fewer and further between. I will say this. When they said the play was under review, now, mind you, in the stadium, you can't always see what's going on. So when they said it was under review, I said to myself, I swear to God, Jimmy, if you dropped this pass, I may never forgive you. But now he caught the ball. He got the first down. I don't think we need to discuss whether or not it was controversial, but I do want to discuss an interesting strategy point because after the game, If they ruled him short, it would have been fourth and inches. Matt LaFleur said after, and it's easy to say this, but after the game, Matt LaFleur said he was going for it if they had ruled him short. Would you guys now, and granted hindsight's everything, but would you have been on board with that decision? And very quickly, because we're running really long on time here, but Paul, let's start with you. Would you have agreed with that decision, and what would your play call have been?
100% would have gone for it. During the review, as I was sitting here with my wife, I looked over and I said, if they reverse it, they need to go for it, end the game. And as far as what play, you got 12 under center, put the ball in his hands. And Matt LaFleur has been aggressive this year in a number of situations. So I do believe him when he said he would have went for it. But put the ball in 12's hands and let him win it for you.
Okay, Jason?
I don't know, man. My conservative nature says, as much as I didn't want to see Russell Wilson get the ball back, I also want this. I want them to have to go as far as they can, because he also makes some dumb mistakes and he plays like crap at Lambeau Field. So to me, I would have. No, he hadn't. But he still owes us one, because we hadn't gotten our signature interception because Kevin King dropped it earlier in the game. So I would have wanted Seattle to have to struggle a little bit more. I probably would have. Been more on board with kicking, but you get so full of adrenaline at that point. Had they gone for it, I would have been all full of piss and vinegar and just said, cram it up the middle with Jones or whatever it is, and let's get the hell out of here, just like Vince Lombardi told Bart Starr in the Ice Bowl.
Perfect segue. All gas, no brakes. Quarterback sneak. I'm all with it. They ran one earlier in the game. I think they would have had an opportunity for that. Run up, Aaron, get them old bones ready to take a couple of hits, but all gas, no break. We're going for it. I don't want to see, because here's the other thing. At that point, I think Green Bay was around the 35-yard line or something like that. If they punt, we're talking about probably two plays where Seattle makes up the yardage from the punt. So you might as well go for it. Save yourself the drama. If they get it, again, it's a one or two play difference. So I was with it. I was with go for it. Thankfully, we don't have to worry about that because they converted. It was a first down. Jimmy Graham got the first down. The game was over. The Packers kneeled out the clock and were able to kneel the game away and advance to the NFC Championship game. And that is where they will be. It will be Sunday at 5:40 Lambeau time against the San Francisco 49ers, who beat the Minnesota Vikings pretty easily. I think the game was competitive for a little bit. It was about how I expected. I think Minnesota kept it competitive, but ultimately San Francisco was just too much and they started to pull away a little bit there. Guys, real quick from around the NFL, just maybe 30 seconds, just some brief thoughts on the other playoff games that happened this weekend. Jason, I'll start with you.
Can't sleep on Tennessee anymore. The fact that they're winning games, I mean, they beat the Ravens. The Tennessee Titans remind me of the 2010 Packers. They are full 2010 Packers mode right now. So now they're going into Kansas City to take on the number 2 seed. This was the exact same path, obviously, a 6 seed took to get to a Super Bowl, and I won't be surprised if the Tennessee Titans are representing the AFC. That was a fantastic effort against the Ravens. Ravens, wow. I mean, who didn't think that it was going to be, Baltimore versus, we'll wait and see who it's going to be in the NFC side. The Niners-Vikings game, okay, I guess it can't be too surprised. It became pretty apparent early on that Kirk Cousins wasn't going to be able to pull any kind of magic on the road that he had been. And despite Jimmy throwing a couple of bad balls, which was good to see if you're the team playing the 49ers next week, San Francisco had that locked up pretty well. I was really surprised to see Houston fall apart the way that they did. I mean, that game was just everything I talked about. Everything that's gotten you here is going to manifest itself in the playoffs. The Texans went full Texans, and Kansas City, all gas, no break. Patrick Mahomes reminded me so much of Aaron Rodgers 10 years ago. That was just – it was an absolutely incredible effort on their part, and they deserve to be there. And there's a really cool prospect of the idea of Super Bowl I repeating itself. Obviously, we want that because that means the Packers get in, but it's awesome that's even a chance. It was another great weekend of playoff football.
Paul, real quick.
Yeah, the Titans and Derrick Henry. Derrick Henry's got 52 guys on his shoulders right now, and he's carrying them through the Patriots, through the Ravens. Incredibly impressive performance and job well done by Mike Vrabel. you know, they finished 9-7 this season, but they're rolling right now. And postseason's all about getting hot at the right point, and that's where they are. The Texans and Chiefs, that was the most Bill O'Brien loss, you know, I think we've ever seen so far. So technically, I'm not that shocked that it happened, honestly. And Patty Mahomes is just a special guy. And then Niners-Vikings, like you said, Jacob, played out kind of how we expected it to.
Yeah, the Titans and Ravens, I still didn't completely believe what I was watching until it had kind of sunk in afterwards that that's what I had watched. You know, I think that there's going to be a lot of people that pile on Lamar Jackson and the Ravens, and you can't win that way and blah, 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 blah. But really, I think it's just chalked up to a bad night, and Tennessee matched up well with them. I said I thought Tennessee had the second best path to victory of your road teams for the weekend. So they've played well. They deserve it. I think they're in a little bit of trouble. I think the Chiefs are a different animal. And I'll reserve my prediction for when we do the Packers-Niners show. But that's what I think. The other games, I think they played out about how we expected. I mean, the Niners and the Vikings and then Kansas City. I mean, I expected them to blow out Houston. I just didn't expect it to look like that. So that's what we have. We have hit 1 hour of content today. So that is a fantastic amount of content for a Packers playoff win. I guess that's what it does. Green Bay wins 28-23. They will take on the San Francisco 49ers, and we will have content for you all week long talking about Packers and 49ers. Green Bay, the most fraudulent and undeserving 13-3 team ever, now has a chance to be the most undeserving team to go play for the Super Bowl. And it's crazy to think about that, but that will do it for this edition of Pulse of the Pack. Be sure to check out our YouTube channel, Pulse of the Pack. Follow the show on Twitter at Packer Pulse. Follow Jason. He's at Jason Perrone. And Paul, I never remember if there's an underscore, but is there an underscore? It's Paul underscore Brettel, B-R-E-T-L. And you can follow me. I'm at Jacob Westendorf. Packers moving on. Seahawks going home. Thank you guys for listening. And go Pack, go.
Of the Pack Podcast.